Hello and welcome to the Bad Vibes Club. My name's Matt and you're here for the third in a series I made with Andrea Franchi called 10 Texts on Sculpture. My little daughter is helping me record this so you can hear her in the background. Is that your cushion?
Yeah.
Okay. This time we're looking at writing by the artist Felida Barlow, who was a sculptor and who wrote excellently on sculpture. She was also famously a teacher for a long time at the Slade. She died relatively recently, I think it was this year, 2023. And I was very saddened by that. She was one of my sculptural heroes, still is. The texts we're looking at are her artist proposal for the Tate Britain Commission she had in 2014. I think the proposal was written a few years before that. You can find that online. And we also read The Hatred of the Object by Felida Barlow and Hearsay, Rumours, Bedsit Dreamers and Art Begins Today, which I think is the text from a lecture she gave. And all of those texts are available as PDFs from my website, dekersaint.com/badvibesclub. That's dekersaint.com/badvibesclub. Me and Andrea talked about Barlow's work, her particular style of kind of monumental sculpture. We talked about her writing, obviously. We talked about an incredible technique she's kind of developed, where she uses dismissal as an important feeling, the dismissal of certain questions in art history, the dismissal of certain ways of working as a meaningful aesthetic interaction. And we talked about this in relation to her being an artist writing rather than a theorist or a curator or an art historian, someone who's writing to make rather than writing to assemble things into some kind of grand theory. We talked about assemblage or sculpture as a conglomeration. We talked about a series of sculptures known as the Object 4 series. Andrea doesn't mention the title, so I just thought I'd mention that. If you Google Object 4 television, that's the famous one that the Tate owns, but there's various others of those. We talked about Felida's advice as a teacher, which was always to put your sculptures outside, apparently. Andrea posed the idea that no one outside of Britain cares about British art, which maybe is disputable, but was funny at the time. We talked about suspended sculpture. We came back to Michael Fried's Art and Objecthood in terms of the art, space and viewer relationship, which Felida Barlow, exploited so successfully in so many exhibitions. We talked about Barlow's very interesting critical understanding of what the vitrine does, these kind of glass cabinets, vitrines, what they do to art. And we mentioned Claire Bishop's quite recent essay on research art. It's on Art Forum and it's called Information Overload, if you want to find that. I couldn't remember the name at the time. And we talked about art that's made for photos, the internet and social media versus art that's made for the gallery. So yeah, if you want to read those texts, then go to dekersaint.com/badvibesclub or just listen to us waffle and I'll be back at the end. Welcome to the Bad Vibes Club. My name's Matt and I'm here with Andrea.
Do I need to say something? Yes.
Yeah, that's fine. And today we're going to be speaking about Felida Barlow, who is the British sculptor who died last year. Is that right?
2022? Maybe this year?
I'm going to Google it. She was the first artist, or actually the first famous person that I was just really sad when she died. Yeah, 23.
Yeah.
She died in March 2023 and has been making work, or had been making work, for almost 60 years. And we are looking at a specific text, but we're going to float around between a few texts that she's written and that people have written about her, and also an interview with her. But we're really looking at her artist proposal, which is published by the Tate. And it was her proposal, presumably edited and cleaned up, for her Tate Britain Commission in the Devine Galleries in 2014. So it's first written in 2012. And what I thought was really interesting about, I've actually used it for teaching before when I did a session on writing proposals. But what I thought was really interesting about it was how she draws on art history and historical debates in British sculpture, very specifically about British sculpture, because it's in the Tate Britain, to just describe what she then goes on to create in the Devine Gallery. So we can also talk about the Devine Galleries commission and how it differs from what she originally proposes. But I thought it was really nice in terms of a piece of artist writing that is functional, but also presents what I would call like a concept of sculpture, like what she thinks sculpture is and what it does and what she wants it to do. Do you have anything to add to that definition or description?
No, I just think it's good to pay attention to this. That is the first text that we're reading that was actually written by an artist. So it's like a very different type of writing, and it has like a lot of personality and polemic, and she's like really it's not that she's being dismissive, but she's kind of like very honest about the stuff that she's interested on, which is quite different from the other stuff that we were reading that were like interested in positioning certain things as important and kind of like they were making, you know, they're like sort of like promoting a hierarchy of the art or something like, and this is not interested in doing that. This is like, it's really nice to read because it just feels, it is trying to convince that her position, you know, has merit and it's going to do something. But at the same time, it's really just like, defending a very personal, it's not universalizing anything. Yeah. It's like defending a very personal understanding of what sculpture is and what is good, you know, not what is good, but what will be fun and interesting to put on that space.
Okay, that's great. So where do you think we should start?
Well, it's interesting that her second paragraph cites Duchamp, which I feel is like, I never paid attention before, but I feel like now I feel like Duchamp comes in every sculptural text.
So do you want to read the quote? Because that is quite a good quote.
As the influence of Marcel Duchamp claimed intellectual high ground during the late 50s and onwards, the status of invented form and the hand processes of sculpture became symptomatic of old-fashioned and moral attitudes produced towards producing art.
I thought that actually the end of that paragraph was interesting as well. The culmination of those debates was the idea that there was no such thing as sculpture. Art was art, and that was that. And I think what Barlow does over and over again in her writing is set herself up against the idea of mediumlessness or mediumless art. She is certain that sculpture has particular qualities and that she and lots of other artists are invested in those qualities. And that's interesting in relation to, maybe we've spoken about installation a few times in these podcasts, and might come back to it with Rosalind Krauss later on, is that that's what Rosalind Krauss says is the problem with installation, is that it claims that it doesn't need what she calls the ground of medium, as in like, it doesn't claim to be sculpture. It claims to be a kind of anything that you want it to be. Anyway, that's maybe like going too far into the future. But I think that definitely is something that Barlow doesn't like. She likes the idea of sculpture and responding to sculpture as a tradition, but in really interesting ways.
I think before we move on from this paragraph, I think I'm quite interested in what she's saying about the hand process of sculptures becoming, symptomatic of old fashioned and moral attitudes, because like, the handmade and the touch is something that, is the whole thing that started this. And also like the question, you know, that Duchamp make that old fashioned, which I think we kind of like sort of dismantle in a way already. But she has this, she will talk about this in the Hatred of the Object, which is one of the other texts that we read. She comes back to this kind of like, to explain what she mean by this handmade object, which is interesting to me because in a sense, when I look at her work, I find it super handmade. Like there's something really industrial, but also handmade. So I was really puzzled about what she meant there. And I think on the Hatred of the Object, she's talking about craft and handmade as having kind of this moral weight of someone spent so much time and has so much skill doing that you immediately is like calling for your affection and your love in a way. It's like it's an object that is demanded to be treated in that. And I think that's the moral ground of it that she finds problematic. I think one of the things she's interested about her is like she's really into, you know, ambiguity and confusion and having the viewer not understand how to relate to that thing. And I think what she's mentioning here about what happened with the handmade or the hand process after Duchamp is this idea that the handmade object is needy.
That's good. I like that. She actually also, I think that maybe in another piece about bedsit art, I can't remember what the title is, but it's another lecture she gave at a conference. Hearsay, Rumours, Bedsit Dreamers and Art Begins Today, which she gave at a Whitechapel exhibition conference in like 2002 or something. She points out that thing about how much labour goes into a sculpture, how much work goes into a sculpture. She lists that alongside other things that were really exciting to British sculptors, and she dismisses as not being that interesting. The other thing being truth to materials, which is really interesting, like the stuff that was happening in pre-1960s British sculpture, which was all about like making sure wood looked like wood and, you know, carved stone looked like carved stone, stuff that I associate with 1930s Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth and stuff like that. And yes, obviously in this piece, the proposal, she uses the other big debate in British sculpture, which is about pierced sculptures or holes in sculptures. Should we move on to that, or did you want to? Oh yeah, that's the next quote you've got, right? So she's referring back to some British sculptors in terms of, you know, what's in the Tate collection and how she might kind of cite her work in relation to those debates. And she talks about the whole, you've got the line, so we've both got the same.
That's a good sign.
We've got both got the same quote. Do you want to read it?
At the time, however, there were issues about sculpture that perplexed me. The hole in sculpture, as in Hepworth's sculptures and Moore's, and its idealization, did not make sense to me. It was claimed that the hole changed how the sculpture behaved in space. Maybe, but in the end, for me, it was just a hole.
That is very dismissive. But that is really important in terms of it being artist writing. Exactly what you said in that introduction, right, is that that dismissal would be unacceptable if you were an art historian. But what she actually does is she uses that dismissal as the basis for basically a big discussion of negative space in sculpture, of how to have space within a sculpture, how to have space around a sculpture. She ends up talking about suspension and stuff. And that really directly does come from a real engagement with that debate around holes in sculpture or pierced sculptures or however they describe them. But the engagement is dismissal. That's what's interesting, right? It's dismissal as a form of engagement. Like, you can, like, as an artist, that is a way that you can engage with something.
I mean, we're all haters, right? Artists. We just go through the world hating things. I think that that's a big part of part of the process. And to be able to, like, articulate it and say it and not feel that that's a bad feeling, in a sense. But that's, like, an important aesthetic interaction, totally. An intellectual interaction.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a way, like you say, like, more formal text, you know, that have certain, like, politeness rules, or, like, you know, like, there are different ways in which manners, or, like, the way you can relate to things manifests, you know, in different structures. So
do you think that is just politeness, or do you think there is something about the field of art history where,
well, I don't know,
dismiss it just wouldn't work as, so, a, like, bit of art history?
We've, like, just been talking about Michael Fried's Art and Objecthood, and that's, yeah, like, dismissal, right? Like, that's a text of a guy saying, like, I hate minimalism, is stupid.
But he's not doing art theory, he's doing, like, live contemporary criticism of stuff that he thought was stupid. But yes, that is a good point. He's very dismissive. After this, we've literally got the same quotes. Okay, so after she talks about this hole and how, for her, it's just a hole, she has a really lovely description of what the sculptural object does. Can I read that one?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so she says, the sculptural object blocks, interrupts, intervenes, straddles, perches, and above all, occupies the space we might otherwise occupy ourselves. Despite its usually static identity, the sculptural object is restless and unpredictable in how it can use space. It is not necessarily a comfortable or comforting experience. And obviously that's just lovely anyway. Firstly, because it talks about what the sculpture does, not necessarily what the sculpture is. Like, even when it's talking about where it's about it occupying, which is a verb rather than an adjective, right? If I'm getting those things right. Anyway, but also what I really like about this is, she's, what's the word? Planting a flag for what she thinks sculpture should do. It's a normative claim, right? When you say that something does something, you're not actually saying that every sculptural object does this. You're saying your ideal sculptural object does all these things. Lots of sculpture fails to do this very unspectacularly. And then also it makes me think of another quote that I use quite a lot, is that she said that sculpture stands up against the world. And I really love that because it's so antagonistic. But also this sense that it relies on the world. So sculpture's against the world, like it has this antagonistic relation with the viewer and with the space that it's in. But it also, the rice is cooked.
Yeah, the rice is cooked, sorry. I forgot about that.
We'll just let the beat go off, it's fine. Yeah, so sculpture has this antagonistic relationship, but it also relies on the space that it antagonizes or kind of occupies or whatever to make it stand up.
But it's interesting because to me, like, I like this sentence so much more than the sculpture against the space, just because...
Oh, which sentence, sorry?
The sculpture object blocks, interrupts, intervenes, straddles, perches, and above all, occupies the space we might otherwise occupy ourselves, because there's just so many variants. Like, I feel like it says a lot about our personalities. Like, because your sentence is such a, like, a, I don't know, it's like a call to war of what sculpture can be or something. That there's something really, I don't know if authoritative is the question, but there's something.
Oh, what, the making things stand up against the world?
Yeah.
What is it, did I say? Stands up against the world, yeah.
Well, this is kind of like a muddled, thing that, something can do a few things and other things. Yes. There's something about, which I was starting to get very worried because we've been looking at all these historical texts, and then I was thinking about contemporary sculpture, and I was like, oh my God, how are we going to do this transition? Because there's so many things that happen in sculpture now that were not, that are really not part of this text in a certain way. And one of the things that I was thinking was about the kind of like the sculpture that occupies space and functions almost like an internal grammar or something, you know, like a sculpture that has like lots of different pieces and is like, and all these different objects are talking to themselves. And to me, that sentence sort of introduces that.
Okay, nice. Yeah, yeah. Like the sculpture is assemblage or the sculpture is conglomeration or something.
Yeah.
And yeah, we have been speaking mostly about things that sit or stand. And yeah, I think, but I think Barlow's really interesting for that because she had such a, well, yeah, she had such a long career, and she, I think she does operate across those ways of working, or she's maybe a touchstone for lots of people who are making like sculpture that we would associate with a more contemporary aesthetic, which takes in a less kind of physical realm, but there is still spatial or something. And I think that's the argument that I think I'm interested in, is that there is a continuum between boring old Henry Moore, Phyllida Barlow, and I don't know,
Jessie Darling.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, and I think in this commission specifically, she does use the space in that way.
Did you see this commission in?
No, I just saw the catalog of the commission.
Okay, yeah.
The commission, but it goes back to like some, again, to that like critique of minimalism. And I read this text thinking about, because I had to read the Fried text, just thinking about that critique of minimalism a lot, because I think she actually uses space. She kind of like mixes the lump with the minimalist use of space at the same time.
Okay, so you're talking about the theatricality of the viewer in the space, right? Is that what you mean? The viewer and the object and that kind of relationship?
Yeah, and I was thinking because I think, as I understand the Fried, it's more about like the object and the space, the idea that the object, you know, is not constituted by itself, but the object expects you to understand the space around it. In a way, I think that's one of the things. And the other thing is this idea of, it's almost like the minimalist object is an object that is looking back at you.
Yeah, it addresses the viewer. That's what I think. I think that sculpture after the 60s addresses the viewer. And it, in a way, it's a bit like the idea of post-conceptualism or something in Peter Osborne. Like, you can't now make work that doesn't address the viewer in some way, I think.
Especially, I think, sculpture. You can't. It's just not very good.
Maybe that's it. Yeah, that's it. If your work isn't addressing the viewer in some way, and it's, you know, it's, there's more or less like controlling relationships between art and its viewer. But yeah, I think that is the moment when, what was your phrase? It looks back. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. There's like this book by this philosopher called George D.D. Huberman, which for some reason has never been translated to English. I don't think so. But he's like a French philosopher, and he was like very big in Brazil when I was at uni. And he keep popping up when I was looking at the Fried stuff, because so he has this famous text which translated something like, what we look at, what looks back at us. And his whole point about minimalist sculpture is that those objects are like empty and they hold something, and the fact that they hold something is important because there's something in there that is looking back at us. And then I just think this sentence is so amazing, the sculpture object blocks, and it finishes with, occupy the space we might otherwise occupy ourselves. Barlow sculptures have that thing where, yeah, like the sculpture is a being that is occupying a space that could be your space. In a way, I just went to Tate Britain last week to see all the sculptures that she mentioned on the, not all the sculptures, but like the sculptures that she mentions on the, yeah, it's such a different, I still don't completely get the art and object. I still don't completely get the Fried's distinction of, you know, the object that is completely encapsulated and the object that is like looking back or something. But there is something there, and there's something lacking to me. You know, when I look at Hepworth or Moore or all of those things are like, they do feel very enclosing themselves in a sense.
Can we just talk about the fact that she refers to another Duveen Gallery commission, which is really lovely. She talks about Martin Creed's work number 850, which was a commission for Tate Britain's Duveen Galleries, and used the length of the space. She says the pounding. Oh, and it was a set of performers who were athletes who ran the length of the space, sprinted the length of the space. I don't know, every minute. I can't quite remember. Did you see that one?
No.
Okay, yeah. But I can't remember if there was ever more than one runner running at any one point. Anyway, her quote is, "The pounding feet of Martin Creed's runners combined with the emptied out space of the Devines created a powerful sculptural experience. The space behind the runners, the space they had just vacated, was as potent as the space they were fleetingly occupying. This emptying out is key to how I want to activate the Devine Gallery's floor space." Which is really lovely, right? She's talking about something that you might think of as performance, I suppose, or like, what would you call it? I suppose I'd think of it as performance. But she just claims it for sculpture. She just says it created a powerful sculptural experience. Or perhaps because of her position as a sculptor, she's like, that's the bit of it I was interested in. Which is just great. Like, she just dispenses with having to deal with it as, I know, a live encounter, for example. And refers to everything in terms of space. And then she has this idea of excavating or emptying out in terms of a way of activating. Which I think is super interesting in what you're saying in terms of minimalism. Like, there's a space inside the sculpture. And actually, when she writes about other artists, she wrote a lovely, that essay, The Sneeze of the Louise, about Louise Bourgeois. She talks a lot about the spaces inside the sculptures, inside Bourgeois sculptures, which doesn't happen loads in Barlow's sculpture. Not in the way that she talks about in other people's sculpture. But yeah, there is a lot of space. But I don't think there's lots of like insides or interior space.
I don't know. I mean, she has done so much stuff. Like, yeah. I was just looking through the catalogues and there's like, I didn't know so much of her work. Like, so many different phases. And
there's one you sent which looks like, yeah, they're great.
Some of the things have.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
This sense of like.
We just look at it, some pictures of, they look like works from the 80s or 90s, right? They're not.
95. Yeah. It's called Red's Body Thing Lie.
Yeah, so they have slits in that kind of open up multiple layers of fabric, but they don't, they're not holes in that way, if they're not pierced, right? Because under the fabric is just more fabric, or like the interior is just like another surface, which I really like. Like, that's one of the things I like about hers, is that it's layers and layers of surfaces. She's got a few pieces that I can't find images of, but which are described as tape or wrapping material wrapped upon itself, like over and over and over again. And I really like that idea that it's pure surface or something, like there is no interior, there's just like layers and layers of what would normally be used to cover something else. There was a section of that monograph that you sent called Studio, which I didn't think the essay was that accurate, because it does that thing of referring to her as like someone who looks in skips and stuff, which she has roundly refused. Yeah, she's like, she's, that is not where I get my materials from. Anyway, but it did show really some lovely images of her studio in the 80s and 90s, which was a bit of her house, her family home, and like a side return with like a cover, you know, like a plastic roof on. And all these sculptures are just like crowded in there, just like totally stuck in this like little pathetic kind of studio, probably like getting rained on every now and again. And, you know, getting in, like literally getting in the way of, like, you know, you got to get to the bins or something and you have to like clear out her sculptures. I just thought that was such a nice picture, because I think last time you made a really good point, or maybe in the first podcast, you made a really good point that I kept talking about the relationship between the artist and the artwork. And I think you'd been talking about, we were at cross purposes in one of the questions, because you'd been talking about relationship between artwork and the viewer, and I was just thinking, oh yeah, like, I just sometimes I don't think about that. Sometimes I just think about the artist and the artwork in the studio. Felida Barlow has this really weird thing where, like, yeah, for quite a long time she wasn't really showing that much work. Like, she always had shows, but yeah, her like big upsurge in popularity in the early 2000s onwards led to much bigger commissions, which involved thinking about the spectator a lot more, and that shows in the writing. I think that she starts thinking a lot about the spectator, but she had this grounding, which is the lump, the object, the thing that sits in your studio and calls out to you and asks you to come and work on it or whatever.
But I think that was one of the things that surprised me, first of all, well, because us, obviously, like, I just arrived here in the 2008 or something, so what I know from Barlow, which I didn't know anything from her in Brazil, is like, you know, post this tale of like, but then looking at the catalogs, she had so much shows. She has so many shows in the 90s. She's like, she's been constantly, you know, I heard this tale of like this woman who was like teaching an art school, and then she was a sort of like, you know, discovered by this like Studio Voltaire show, and then become, you know, get these shows and stuff like that. And so that was one of the surprises. But the other thing, like reading her text, is like how she's always like finding ways to show. So she talks about, you know, like showing stuff, like the series, which I always, again, like I I had heard that it was like, you know, she had her kids and whenever she had time, she would put the sculptures in her house to photograph it. And it's not like that at all.
Yeah, I didn't realize
she
that.
Goes to like people's houses and friends and put the sculptures in those places. And she talks a lot about, you know, putting sculptures on the street. And then sometimes she just lets them go to the trash and sometimes she recovers. But she's someone who, it seems like since art school, she is constantly making an effort to like put the work in the world and see what happens. Like she's really interested in what happens when the work is in the world, which is something really interesting in terms of like, again, like students and, you know, how we think about, yeah, like occupying space or putting stuff like this idea that, you know, she's not putting stuff on the street to do like a temporary show for other people. She like, she literally wants to know what happens when the stuff is out there, which is a really lovely way to phrase it. And then I was reading this other book called Changes, which is very weird, but it's like a series of interviews with people that teach.
Wait, did you stutter or is that
no
the
is that
title?
The name like CHCHCH
like David
changes.
Bowie, right?
Changes. That's sort of the vibe. It's like a book interviewing lots of people that teach at different art schools I think mainly in London, but also like some in Europe. And she's saying, well, it's really funny, like I'm sure like as you interview people you have like, you know, these different things that teachers, you know, that specific teacher always does, and it's the same advice they always give to students. So if you interview my students, they will say like, oh, you know, Phyllida always says put your sculpture on the street. I know you're doing this in the studio, but have you taken it out on the street and see what happens? And I thought, oh, that's such a good advice. I should start saying that to all my students. Just take it on the street.
First thing.
And see what happens. Yeah. So there's something about that. Yeah. That relationship to the world that I didn't realize until like, going through this like reading, which is not, it's not even like a relation with the viewer necessarily. It's a relation of the sculpture with the world.
Yes. That's a great point to make, that it's not always about the viewer, but about the space that the sculpture is in.
Yeah, she's not like saying, oh, and then people come and they see, or I put it in a place where people could see. She doesn't seem to be interested at all in how people see that thing. She just want to put it there and see, yeah.
Yeah, those sculptures you're talking about in domestic spaces are called, they're always called object for. So object for television, object for ironing board, object for piano. What's the other one that's really good? There's objects for shelves, which I couldn't find the images for in the book. But I always thought they were in her house. And there's several narratives about her work. One, that she was discovered, which is partially, it's true in a particular way, in the sense that she was showing really regularly, obviously, because otherwise she wouldn't be a teacher at the Slade, right? Like you wouldn't necessarily have a good position in a teaching school if you weren't showing. But in the early 2000s, she starts getting these big institutional shows, which involve her planning and producing a show in big spaces. The one I remember is in 2004 at the Baltic in Gateshead, and it blew me away in that cliched way, because of the way it used vertical space, the way it used the height of this massive old industrial building. The second one is that she finds stuff in skips or finds things on the street, and she's categorically denied that. I can't imagine it's totally untrue, but she has categorically denied it, right? She says she buys new materials, like if she wants whatever insulating board, she goes and buys a load of insulating board from a builder's merchant. And she makes the point in a really nice lecture, the Bedsit Hearsay Dreamers lecture, that the artist studio at a certain point starts taking inspiration from elsewhere. So she talks about the dressmaker's studio, the kitchen, the builder's merchants. And yeah, for her, I suppose it is the roadworks and the builder's merchant. They're inspiration, but she doesn't find her material. She buys them just like those people would buy them. And then the third one is, yeah, this idea that her life was totally overrun by domestic work, which is always true for anyone with the family. So like that, again, isn't untrue. But if you're teaching art, like, and you have a studio, like you're also doing those two things.
She was also very annoyed, and one of the things saying like, people talk to me as if I was a single mother, and she's like, partner who has a studio in our house.
Oh, that's funny. Okay, what do you want to do next? Oh, we should talk about the lump, right?
Oh my god, her language for sculpture, like I put like holes, lumps, ugly shapes. It's like the way she names, yeah, the words she uses are so cool. As like again, in like this way that is like not, you know, these are not sculptural like they're sculpture words, but they're not like, you know, there's not someone who's using like, yeah, theory words, using something that is like very directly related to how they see the world or something. And it's very cool.
Yeah, it's great. I really like Lumps. But I think actually in a weird way, that really does place her in British sculpture. Like when she went to art school in the, I suppose in the 60s. And the way sculptors talked about their work, which was this overly anti-theoretical way. And they did talk about Lumps. She says she talks about is it Henry Dalwood or Hugo? Oh, Hubert Dalwood's large object as a lump. And I think those were talked about as lumps, but as like a new form that the sculpture hadn't really embraced before. So in a way, it's like, it is brilliant, but it also does locate her as like part of the tradition that she's also kind of being dismissive about. She dismisses Bernard Meadows, but likes Hubert Dalwood's, which are like these kind of ugly sculptural lumps.
But I think one of the things that it's cool in her it comes in the Betsy's essay, and it came over and over in everything that I read, which I really love, is like she really disliked Anthony Caro, which I also really dislike Anthony Caro. And she talks about how lucky she was that she didn't study with him.
Where was he then? Was he teaching?
So she studied Chelsea. She did her BA at Chelsea, and then she studied at she did her MA at Slade, and he was at Centre St. Martin's, you know, like, and kind of like defining a lot of what I think is the most boring British sculpture.
Yeah.
And I was just like really happy that she agreed with me. I was like, oh, it's not only me. It was the most boring British sculpture. But also like, so in a sense, even like, I don't know enough British sculptures to know where the lump comes, but I do, from all the things she written and stuff, get enough to see that there is a scene in the 60s that she feels 100% not included. And that have no space for the type of work she's doing or how she's doing.
Yeah, that's the new generation sculpture show, right? Which Barlow doesn't talk about feminism a lot. She doesn't use that word very much, but that's one of the times where she makes explicit that, like, you know, that world was sexist. She talks about the new generation show as being totally all male artists, and sculpture as a kind of, what do you call it, a masculinist preserve, or so I can't remember her phrase. But yeah, there's moments where she does explicitly talk about gender, and that gang around Anthony Caro, yeah, she says that a lot of people galvanized in opposition to those sculptors, and I do understand that, and that makes total sense. But also I have recently quite liked Anthony Caro,
because, yeah, so this is your chance, convince us.
Well, I won't be able to tell you why, because the reason I just started looking at him again was because, oh, who is it? Olivia Bax, who teaches at Camberwell. She did a talk, and she worked with Caro, obviously, in his very much later years, and she helped make some of his sculptures. And she says in the lecture, she's not like a massive fan of Caro, but she does like some of his smaller stuff. And then she showed just a really lovely sculpture, which made me totally rethink like why he's using all those like steel beams and stuff that look really. But there is something in there about like taking from elsewhere that I think is interesting, because this little sculpture, I think, had a tap fitting on or something. There was something that was like, oh, it's not just industrial materials. There's like something about just other spaces that aren't traditional spaces. But I do understand why people don't like Caro. That kind of monochrome, smooth look that Barlow rightly critiques as kind of essentially boring.
Right? I think it's also the authority, right? It's like, it's someone who's like, you just feel that it's mandated. And I think that's very annoying. Like, it changes the way you relate to things. And I think the fact that, again, like, he was teaching and he has so much power in the British art all the time. I think that's the problem.
Yeah,
is when people that do certain specific things, which, I mean, maybe was excellent, I don't know, but they become like this hegemonic force that you feel that you have to take in, because otherwise you're not the certain class of people, you don't have the certain taste. It's like this thing that is dictating a specific taste, or like, this is what British sculpture is. And then that's what becomes, at least to me, like really hard to like deal with. Like, I can't separate him from, him being forced down on me, basically.
Oh, was he someone that was referred to in your studies, Carol?
Well, not so. No one outside of Britain cares about British art.
Yeah.
But in the 90s, when Tony Blair had his whole campaign, the British Council, there was this whole scene in the 90s to try to, you know, like do like a nation-making process through the arts. So Yuhalai Saatchi doing Sensation, which is a paid exhibition that goes all over the world. Like, he rents places to kind of like tell people this is. And then the British Council does this show called Bigger Splash that also goes all over the world. They rent the Guggenheim, they rent the Oca in Brazil, they rent quite a, I think they rent a museum in every, or like quite a few Latin American capitals. So the British government pays and put these things and construct this history of like British art. And Caro was like a big thing there. And for us who have like a very long tradition of sculpture with like industrial and planes and stuff like that, it's like, why? What? You know, it was this very clear sense of like, you don't want to engage with what was happening here at the time. You just want to bring this thing from the outside without talking about, you know, the massive influence that American art has in Caro. You just like completely raise that and it becomes like, you know, this genius of British sculpture that can like, now you want to rewrite at this person who influenced sculpture all over the world, which is not true. So that's my first contact with Caro. So those things are a big influence because, again, like they do come as very purposeful, soft power strategies that arrive at us. It's very hard not to.
Yeah, that's one thing she says, annoying. Right, in her lecture about that generation of sculptors. They just didn't admit the obvious effect that American developments in American the American art scene had had on them, and then they just did kind of shit versions of it. Okay, so what does she do then after she kind of talks about the hole and the lump? Oh, she talks about suspension. She then starts talking about suspended sculpture. How does she get there? Do you think?
Oh, she's talking about, you know, Claes Oddeburg, I think.
Yes.
That's like a hanging lump.
Yeah.
There's like a Claes Oddeburg electricity plug. It's called giant three-way plug scale of three. The 70s, so that's part of the Tate. The other thing is like all of the examples on Barlow paper on the Tate are in the Tate. They're like, so it's just really nice to read something is referring to things that you can actually see.
Yeah,
potentially. Well, like
I'll try and put the link up. We're going to give all these texts out as PDFs, but I'll try and put the link up for this one because even when it doesn't have an image in the text, it has links out to where that artist is represented in the Tate's collection. And like you say, it's just really nice. And again, something we're trying to do for students when we like start presenting this work is make it really, all the references really clear and make it really easy to access visual material around the more theoretical stuff. And this essay is just really well presented and it's an asset. What's the word? It's a credit to Tate's team that they did a really nice presentation of this piece. So yeah, she's talking about various artists. Who does she say? Arp, Richier, Garbo, Hepworth, Moore, Fontana, Bourgeois, Brancusi, David Smith, all of which revealed a lighter, more visceral, more raw and more spontaneous version of the invented rounded lump form. And then she talks about all these hanging sculptures: Faultrier, Fischli and Weiss, Marissa Mertz, Rebecca Horn, yeah, that Oldenburg piece, hanging sculptures. Oh, and a Bruce Nauman. That's really nice as well. She talks about a collapsed Nauman piece. And I can't remember if the image is in the text.
Oh, she talks about Dorothea Tanning piece like a collapsed
Nauman. That's what she says. Sorry, yeah. But what's really nice is she says, so it's a Dorothea Tanning piece that's on the floor. And she just immediately says, but I can imagine it's suspended. So she takes like someone else's bit of work that has obviously is put on place on the floor by the artist. And Barlow's like, but I think it should be in the air kind of thing. And then that gets her into how she's going to suspend her sculpture. She says, suspended sculpture can be more ambivalent than grounded or plinthed works. The suspended sculpture enables circulating air space above, below and through the works. And here it's where she's like using the whole and using that idea of space inside the sculpture in her own way. As if toying with gravity, which confuses the identity of what we're looking at. These works can claim to achieve what the much idealized whole claims. Suspended sculptures take us by surprise, enabling us to be physically active in how we look at both the object and the space in which it is located, and to be witnesses to an altered state of both.
This is when my brain goes like, freed, like minimalism, like that's what annoys him, right? Like that you're looking at the object and the space which is located.
Yeah, defo. But actually, interestingly, your point there about Barlow not privileging the relationship between the audience and the sculpture. She's saying we, right? So she is talking about the audience, but she's also talking about herself and her relationship with sculpture, whether that's her own or other people's. So that's quite nice in the sense that she's not necessarily separating the artist and the audience there. She's assuming that the audience will want to have this relationship with sculpture as well. Okay, this is where I think it's funny to like then look at what she did in the De Vere galleries. Because what do you think? Do you think... I don't think the word suspended really applies. The works use the full height of the galleries, and they use... It's hard to describe Felida. You have to just type in Felida Barlow De Vere galleries and you'll see. How would you describe... Because there are objects that are up in the air, but they're not suspended, because suspension to me is like hung or something, or hanging from the ceiling, or with no construction below. Oh yeah, maybe that's true. Oh yeah, so there are things suspended, but they're suspended by these huge constructions, these huge frames that are built up from the floor. So it's a very particular... Okay, let's phrase it like this. It's a very particular idea of what suspension might mean, which is very different to the examples that she's using. You know, she talks... I don't know if it's in this essay, but she talks a lot about bourgeois suspended sculpture, which really are just hanging off a wire off the ceiling. And that is not what she's doing in the De Vere galleries at all. And I think that's really lovely that she's kind of setting up this idea of suspension and then doing something quite... different when she actually goes in and does the work.
So this is where I think what she's talking about is when she has this use of theatricality that we were not in agreement if it refers to Frida use of theatricality or not. But she says, in addition, my questioning how sculpture is viewed and experience can be represented through the theatricality of the follies of fake balconies, staircases, and stadium style seating structure. But most importantly, the lump forms suspended at different heights will be free from their usual gravity bound role of the floor and plinth, where half of their bodies remain unseen. These lumps will be hung in such a way that as a group, every aspect of them will be revealed, top, bottom, inside, outside, front, back. And I think that's one of the things that is really, to me, lovely about the way she uses the De Vere is that she does create these weird, like, yeah, balconies or, yeah, staircase. Like, there's all these kind of, like, architectural structures that do nothing or, like, I don't know, constructions. And then the idea of the lump hanging. I think it's interesting that the idea of the hanging is that you can see this object through all dimensions. It seems like that's the most important.
But you can't, because you're on the ground. But that's what's that's really nice, because again, it's like the relationship of the lump being seen from all sides is not with a real audience, it's with the space. Mm-hmm. It's the lump is exposed to all sides, or it's not that the audience can climb up these structures that refer to balconies, it's that these structures refer to balconies in a space that doesn't have any. So it's about the audience being able to like perceive the relationship between the sculpture and the space, rather than the audience having this direct relationship with the object, which is, yeah, theatrical. So, yeah, it is important to distinguish these two forms of theatricality. So, yeah, nice.
Oh, and I was just going to say that, in a way, it is I think the way you're phrasing is interesting, because, yes, like the audience cannot see the object through every side, but the object is visible through every side.
Yeah.
And it kind of like goes back to the putting the object on the world, right? It's like the object is in a world in a position where it's visible side, or like it's not... Again, like the viewer is not necessarily like the person.
Yeah, 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 yeah. The space almost is looking at the work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's what she does when she puts the object in the world as well. It's like she's interested in the relation of the object viewing the space and the space viewing the object somehow, or like having that relationship.
Oh, here's the final quote I took from the proposal. The De Vere floor space, the usual territory for sculptures to be located, will be empty. It will become the audience's territory, and as such, they will become protagonists on equal terms with the work suspended and hung above them. And then I wrote, just included this because it's both borne out in the De Vere Gallery Commission, and it's also hilariously untrue. The floor is full of stuff, and like completely does that thing that she says right at the start of the essay, like it occupies space that the audience member might otherwise occupy, and they have to walk around it to look at the sculptures. But at the same time, the sculptures do have this interesting look where they look like a support structure and a lump, but obviously with Barlow's work, like all of that support structure is also the sculpture. It just happens to be, yeah, it kind of takes on the look of other support structures or architectural features or something.
Well, I have two things. So one I want to say about this sentence, that what I think is interesting is, and I get what she means about it, is like this choice of like make work that is like around the De Vere floor space instead of occupy the centrality of the space. And you know, if you go to Tate Britain now, the way that it's displayed is that you have these massive sculptures in the middle.
Yes.
And then the sides are empty, and then the sides are the audience place. So I think changing those relations are super interesting. I don't know if I think other artists might have done it or something, but like the way that it's set out is like super traditional gallery art space at the moment. And I think for a certain type of sculpture, which sometimes is the way that some students think about sculpture in the studio for the final show, it is to think about the sculpture as this thing that kind of demands all this empty space around it or something to be viewed. So there's something really nice about these sculptures are all against. They're like gigantic and massive, but at the same time they're like occupying, like emptying the center somehow. And then my final quote was a little bit before that, and it's again like I just think her use of language is amazing. And she says, I want to reconsider the language of the whole in relationship to invented form and the lump, where it is an inevitable result of the processes of making, where the uncompromising lump form can be excavated to destruction, expanded, contracted, fractured, poured, drenched, smooth, roughed, and be left half finished, polished, burnt, rebuilt. It can be coming or going, an object about to be or an object that has been. And there's something about like the state of the sculptures, of her sculptures, that have that in a really amazing way, where they feel like hyper-constructed and never finished at the same time. And I just think, you know, just reading the accumulation of verbs and stuff, it is the way her sculptures function. It's like this accumulation of things in tension with each other. And I think it's just so lovely that her writing also does that, or her thinking probably also does that.
So we are at 50 minutes. Should we just throw a few extra things in from other things that we read, or is that we've kind of brought in lots of?
I mean, I think we could talk about the vitrine. I think the vitrine thing is pretty lovely.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the vitrine. So she doesn't actually mention this in the Tate proposal, but in various other essays. Which one are you thinking of? Is it The Hatred of the Object?
Yeah. But so that's just because that's one I read this morning.
So. Yeah. The Hatred of the Object is maybe. I mean, that should definitely be in the bundle of text that we send out. The Hatred of the Object is probably one of her more famous talks that was then turned into an essay, well, you know, kind of edited and transcribed and turned into a piece of writing. So she just does a really good, she just, you know, in terms of her writing being about sculpture and about engaging with art history and engaging with sculptural practice, but also from the position of an artist who can be dismissive and annoyed and the idea of an artist being able to like do polemic rather than having to kind of do a balanced
but also thing. Can we talk about like she's an art teacher, like I want to talk about like this.
Okay
I'm like, huh.
So what did she say about the vitrine, and then we can get into that, because that's a really good point. She obviously taught a lot as well.
Yeah, no, but I mean like it's hard, you know what I mean? I feel quite conscious about the things that I like and then I dislike, and we're saying this in public, and then, you know, I might have students who do those things, and I'm like, oh, maybe this is not. So there's something, and but I think she's right. Like, I think it's much nicer to talk to students from a position of an artist who has opinions that then the students can disagree and articulate with. And so there's something, as I was reading, part of me was like, oh, this is, would I be able to, how would I deal with something like that? And at the same time, I'm like, oh, this is amazing, because there's so many like crucial questions that come because of this position that she takes.
Go on. Is there a quote that about the vitrine that we could work off? I've got a small quote.
Okay.
So she's basically singling out the vitrine as one of the issues around abandoning the studio. She's talking about how the studio is very important for her, and she singles out that vitrine as because it frames, contains, tidies up, cleans up, and she says it is the symbolic equivalent of the screen. It offers the real as anti-real. And then she says, it must be the vitrine's ability to accommodate anything and everything that makes it so compelling. But at the same time, it does more than this. It removes both viewer and artist from the work. It deadens opinion, rendering the status of the object as a wild, unpredictable, difficult, ugly thing. Sorry, that's a fragment of a quote, but she's saying that it like gets rid of that wildness, messiness, unpredictableness, ugliness, difficultness, which she so values in sculpture. But what I would say is that I often say this to students is that, I mean, she's clearly saying that she doesn't like it, but there's no reason why you can't, you know, use deadening, use the fact that it's a symbolic equivalent of real. If that's what you, a symbolic equivalent of the screen, if that's what you want to do, like a vitrine does it really well. Like it just does certain things that she's not interested in doing in her sculpture and she thinks are the antithesis of the kind of sculpture she wants to be. But it doesn't mean that they're invalid. You know, like, I don't know if we can attribute this to Damien Hirst, but Jeff Koons, I think, knows what he's doing when he, like, uses a vitrine. Because he's like, that's what he wants to do, is to create this kind of consumer relationship with his sculpture. It just so happens that Phelida Barlow doesn't like that and doesn't want her sculpture to do that. Does that make sense? But I still like Jeff Koons. I think Jeff Koons does some good stuff with the vitrine.
Yeah, but I think, and this is when, like, I think she being an art teacher is quite important, because I think at some point she talks up when she's criticizing the vitrine, she's saying the vitrine is this thing that, you know, you do it once and then you're solved, right? Every time you show something, just put something inside the vitrine. So in terms of, like, it's like a, becomes, it's quite different from Jeff Koons, because Jeff Koons has a lot of money on art assistants and he makes a vitrine. It's sort of like a choice of among many.
Right.
But what she's saying is, like, if you're a student and you have, like, limited access to the workshop and you need to have a solution and you have no money, then making a vitrine becomes like such an easy solution. And you put all your time and investment in constructing this thing. And then you just spend the rest of the year putting things in the vitrine, because the vitrine is there and you've made it and now you have to use it. So there's a different way in which the vitrine functions in the way she's describing in the art school that it functions in the world, I think.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a really good point. But that's, again, that's something that I, you know, it's like students wanting to use plinths or students wanting to put things on little shelves or wanting to have a handout next to it. You know, all of these things are like decisions that are valid, but you have to realize that they come with certain, they operate in certain ways. But yeah, that's a good point. It makes me think a little bit of Claire Bishop's recent article about research art. Have you read that?
I read it and I don't remember anything about it.
Claire Bishop basically saying, like, certain things just become, certain techniques or whatever become like standard in art that presents itself as research. And they end up being like ways of making the work look like research. So vitrines being one of them, like presenting all these like objects and, you know, texts and stuff in a vitrine tells the audience, oh, by the way, this is boring, but you can look at it and then move on. And this, but it's all like stuff I found that's like interesting to me or interesting to the project or something. And it's kind of similar to what she's saying here, is that it can accommodate everything and puts it all on a level footing. Like, and I think what's interesting about Barlow is that she's interested in hierarchies in sculpture. She's putting, like, literally in terms of height, and she wants certain things higher up than others. And in that Devine Gallery's commission, yeah, she's making lumps that are then held up by other parts of the sculpture that look like their job is just to hold things up. And she's interested in the ambiguity of the relationship between those things and how the viewer looks at things or how the space looks at things or whatever.
But I think it's interesting. So because of the way, you know, she frames the vitrine as like a television film, like computer screen. Hmm. And I'm just thinking about what we were talking before about, like, this kind of new, I don't know if it's a new trend, but like a way of showing work in the art school shows where, you know, you don't just show the object, but you show, you kind of like, the way we define it, which I thought was really interesting, is that you can, like, you create a position for the viewer to kind of like interact with the object. So you kind of, like, you put a sofa there, you put, like, you kind of like define where the viewer should be in relation to the object. And she, again, because of her art school stuff, is really interesting, because another of the essays that we can share is about slides and kind of how to photograph.
Oh, great. I didn't read that one.
Okay. Oh, it's like a critique of, like, what does it mean to do work for slides, and that's the art school kind of like pushes for a certain professionalization of how art should be documented and then how that affects the work. But in a way, she's pointed to something that has accelerated even more, because now, at least for my students, for so many of them, Instagram or Pinterest are the way in which they see work. So in a way, they produce work to, like, reproduce that sort of viewer experience, which is the viewer experience of the vitrine and then the slide, right? Which is like you make the work, but then you want your work to be seen, yeah, in this kind of like very specific It's the opposite of putting the work in the world. It's the opposite of like getting your sculpture and putting it, seeing what happened. And I don't know how to articulate it in a sense, but it feels like she's kind of like raising the alarm. And you know, when she's talking about the studio and the different forms of the studio and what happens when you don't have a studio. Again, like, you know, when teaching art school, we have like more and more students and less studio space, and that those things are accelerating together. Like they're kind of like, she's signaling that these things are connected. And I think it's really interesting to see how they still connected and they kind of like, they're feeding into each other and kind of like, and I'm not saying like they're going to like a bad direction or not interesting direction, but they're going into a direction.
But that is the direction of contemporary sculpture, right? It makes me think of AIDS 3D, you know, that collaboration. I don't know if they're still actually going, but they were Berlin. It was Daniel Keller and, no, they can't be still making work together. Daniel Keller and Nick Cosmas, and they were in Berlin in probably the late 2000s or something, and they would make sculptures, but they would then take a picture and then dismantle the sculpture and the, but to be clear, it wasn't like some kind of performance thing where like they told you that, it was just, that's just like the easiest way to do it, like, and they thought of them as sculptures, and then if they were asked to do a show they could always reassemble it and work out how to make it stand up for longer than an hour or whatever. But yeah, or the jogging, right, like where they would kind of make art, things that looked like artworks, and then put them online, and they would be kind of jokes or memes and also sculptures, but mostly just digital image files and stuff. And again, it's this, the vitrine, yeah, like it starts off that tendency. But the other thing I would say about the vitrine is that in terms of, you know, Eve Sedgwick's that paranoid reading essay, she talks about shame and like the way that when you're looking down, you're kind of acting out shame. And that's also the position of reading, like the bodily position of reading. And the vitrine is like reading art, isn't it? You kind of, I mean, it depends what kind of vitrine, but yeah, you can be like, you're forced to look at things through a certain position.
Like Duchamp.
Like Duchamp, yeah, exactly. So it's, again, it's like Barlow is stating her, what's the word? I'm trying to think of the word, but like, you know, staking her claim to a certain territory. And yeah, there is a moral element where she doesn't like the way certain tendencies in art or whatever. But I think that's just, yeah, maybe that's the, but she also understands them and she does make sense of them in a way. She might be saying like she doesn't like the way that it does X, Y, and Z, but she's also accurate in the sense that she understands what you're doing when you put something in a vitrine. I think that's what makes her a good teacher, right? Like that's the balance between being able to say like, yeah, personally, I fucking hate fishing wire because it does this, this, and this. But if a student can articulate, well, I want it to do this, this, and this back to me, then I'm going to be like, okay, go ahead, use fishing wire. Although that's not true. I do just ban fishing wire. All my students at Colchester, they were like, that's like a running joke now, is that they're all going to like make things with fishing wire, like hanging off fishing wire. It's because we went to see the Cornelia Parker show and they all just like fell in love with it. But yeah, that's a good example, right? Fishing wire is used in situations where you have hyper control over lighting and it does become invisible because it's in the dark and it's not lit. If you're using it in like a well-lit gallery space, it's just fishing wire that people can see. So it's like it's invisibility, like doesn't actually come into being. So if you're using fishing wire, then you just don't understand why fishing wire is used, which is a problem in the art school, right? If your job is to show that you have a methodology and that you understand why you're using certain techniques and materials. And yeah, that's where the vitrine is a problem in the art school, is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, but I think just hearing you talk about the fishing wire is really interesting because it goes back to like her interview about teaching and this thing about saying, oh, my students will all tell you, you know, these are the three things that she will tell you in every tutorial. And I think like this is what I love about Barlow, and maybe it's the thing that I don't get from Caro because of the way he has been historicized, but it's like this kind of like refusal to universalize, like she knows, you know, the cool thing about art school is you're gonna, through your art school, you're gonna meet like 20 different tutors and they're all different artists, and the things that annoy them and the things that they hate and the things that they care about are completely different. And instead of trying to pretend that we're all in agreement and there's these things, it's like it's really cool that all these people have this, you know, I have never thought about fishing wire before. Like,
I fucking hate it. I hate it so much.
But I have the things that I hate. You know what I mean? And I think that's, yeah, there's something about, yeah, making those things visible and kind of like owning this specificities. And that's what Barlow does in her writing, in a sense. Like I feel like she never does, I don't know, it never feels like she's doing claims that are universal. It always feels like she's talking about from like her own practice, her own opinion. This is how I think about things. And then she kind of like, yeah, made these like really polemic statements in a sense. But is fine because she's doing them from this very situated position. And it just means we understand more about her art and her thinking through those.
Yeah. So if we're thinking about part of what this project is about is getting students to think about why they're reading and why they might do writing and stuff. And that's a really good point. Like, Felida Barlow is not trying to write art history. She's trying to help you understand what she's doing as an artist, as a sculptor. Yeah, brilliant. She's just so great.
She's so great. Yeah. Just like, you know, look at all her catalogs, and there's also like documentaries online and she in her studio. And it's just like, she's just, yeah, incredible.
Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to Andrea for taking part. And of course, thanks to Felida Barlow for all that amazing writing and wisdom and art that she left us with. Next time, we'll be speaking about Rosalind Krauss and the expanded field. If you want to get those texts, remember it's decursaint.com/badvibesclub. All right, see ya.